all European states are, on one hand, egalitarian, democratic states, but also they are white supremacist states. And white supremacy flashes out of them every now and then. It hits you. I just wish to make it less easy for this destructive usage of anti-Semitism. It hurts people, Arab people, Palestinian people, but hurts also Jewish people who are subjected to anti-Semitism.
Welcome to the Big Picture Podcast. My name is Mohammed Hassan, and today we ask, is freedom of speech a universal European value? Or is it reserved for some and not others? That's a question raised by Professor Ghassan Hajj, a widely respected Australian sociologist and author who last year accepted a prestigious placement at the Max Planck Institute in Berlin. But just a few months later, he became the target of attacks by right-wing media in Germany, highlighting pro-Palestinian posts he'd been publishing on his private Facebook account and accusing him of anti-Semitism. Then things escalated. The Walt M. Sontag website then reached out to the head of the institute, asking them to review his tenure. And they did, terminating his contract suddenly, saying he no longer aligned with their values. But Hajj isn't going away quietly, and is determined to take his dismissal to court to make a point about academic freedom. Germany has been a staunch and unflinching ally of Israel and continues to sell weapons to its government despite accusations of ethnic cleansing and genocide in Gaza. At the same time, pro-Palestinian voices within the country are routinely silenced, arrested, or forced to dampen their criticism of Israel. So what makes a country that enshrined the guarantee of freedom of expression and opinion into its constitution turn its back on its values? Ghassan Hajj, it's a pleasure to have you with us. Welcome to The Big Picture.
Thank you for having me.
I want to speak to you about the experience that you had most recently in Berlin with the Max Planck Institute, the society, and how it is an example of a wider trend that is happening right now in a lot of Western societies, but specifically in Germany, with regards to Palestinians and pro-Palestinian voices. And I want to begin by asking you to kind of tell us the story of what happened, how long you've been in Berlin, some of the work that you've been working on, focusing on, and then ultimately how it led to this fracture in this relationship with a very distinguished institute.
Well, I mean, it's interesting you say how it led to, because nothing I was doing led to. It was totally what I was doing. It's totally disconnected from what happened to me at the Institute. I was invited to the Max Planck Institute of Social Anthropology. You know, sort of like there's many Max Plancks in Germany, Max Planck of physics, Max Planck of chemistry, and there's a Max Planck Society. The headquarters is in Munich. This institute is in Halle, which is about an hour south of Berlin. And it has three departments. Political anthropology, legal anthropology, and economic anthropology. And the three directors invited me. And basically, they said each department is thriving. There has been some renewal at the Institute. But we are not communicating much among each other as departments. And I have a bit of a reputation for creating spaces of interaction, which get published So I've got, like, I create a concept or something like this, mm-hmm. and ask people to start looking at their research from the concept. Like, I bring people together around the notion of waiting, then around the notion of responsibility. Mm-hmm. The last book I did was about decay. Anyway, so they wanted me to do something similar. And so I created space around, it's very ironic now, but it's around the concept of anthropology of social repair. This is what I spend my time doing. The only thing that hasn't changed for me when being Max Planck is that I'm quite an activist anthropologist on my social media as far as Israel-Palestine is concerned.
And then so October 7th happens, and the fallout from that spills into a lot of Western societies. There's a lot of protest. There's a real feeling of upheaval in a lot of spaces, in Germany as well. And there then becomes this this feeling like the way that German society or the German government is reacting to it is quite hostile. What did you see happening around you in society when that happened?
Well, let me say that I was actually very, very selfish in the sense that, of course, when what you described was happening, a lot of my colleagues here in Australia saying, well, how can you cope with this, etc. And my reaction has genuinely been, look, I'm really having a nice time at Max Planck, and I'm going to take a break. I know it's up here, but I'm not going to involve myself more than I'm usually involved. So I wasn't participating in any demonstrations or speaking at rallies or even speaking on the issue. I was concentrating on what I was describing. As I said, very selfishly, because I was having a lovely time. They loved me, I loved them, and we were just unapologetically bubbling ourselves. But of course, I mean, analytically, my eye was always on that. As an anthropologist of racism and comparative racism, I became interested the way anti-Arab racism was circulating in Germany. And I was looking at it carefully. But all I'm saying is that I didn't speak about it. But I was very carefully looking at. And especially I became interested with the rather exquisite combination, which is a bit of a historical tour de force, really, the way anti-Semitism becomes sort of like subverted historically. And not only is it emptied of its original meaning of what it means to put down seriously hurt Jewish people, but turn it into a mode of racializing Arab people in Germany. So I became fascinated because the more you think about it, I mean, it is genuinely, as I said, a tour de force to actually take a category like anti-Semitism, which was directed as an anti-racist, anti-anti-Semitism, as an anti-racist sort of like force, critically directed at people, and then transform it in this way as a tool of marginalizing Arabs and Palestinians.
Is that what you saw happening? That there was this strain of, there's obviously kind of almost institutionalized
anti-Semitism in Germany now that is connected very deeply to the sense of historical guilt and historical reparations. But then there's also another strand in Germany of this kind of xenophobia, this anti-immigrant, anti-Arab, anti-Turkish kind of sentiment. Were they combining in a way? Is that could you see something like this happening?
Well, I mean, yeah, I could see that, but I mean, that's something that scholars have analyzed long ago. So if you're well read in relation to the history of racism in Germany, the history of German colonialism in Africa, the history of Nazism, and the history of the attempt by German elite to make it as if there is no relation between the history of Nazism and anti-Semitism and the history of racial colonialism. And of course, a lot of scholars have critically shown that there is a relation. Now, when we start talking about anti-Semitism, though, we have to be careful because on one hand, the historical anti-Semitism that existed in German society and that was directed towards Jewish people is still there. It's not that it stopped. And but at the same time, you have this new brand. So I call it kind of like it's like a variant of the virus, you know, and they say so we call it anti-Semitism Z because it's created by Zionists.
So it's like a mutation.
And
of,
so anti-Semitism Z is not the same as anti-Semitism. To be accused of anti-Semitism Z is basically anti-Zionism, and anti. So the moment you show a critique of the desire for ethno-nationalism in Israel-Palestine on the part of Jews who want, who perceive their well-being in terms of creating an ethno-national state, and you criticize this, you are accused of anti-Semitism Z. And so it's very important when we criticizing the instrumentalization of anti-Semitism Z, not to fall into the trap of thinking there isn't still the real anti-Semitism that is happening. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't help that the nature of Zionist politics in general has become quite accommodating to the people who actually have a long history of actual anti-Semitism and direct their animosity towards the people who engage in anti-Semitism, i.e. anti-Zionism. And so we have this incredible transition where on one hand we have a history of these people who are quite powerful ideologically and sort of like militarily and in terms of financial means, sort of like, first of all, moving us to think that anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. But now we've moved to this seriously kind of like strange thing where, and this is quite a fine thing, only anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. So that is, the Zionists are quite happy to engage with all these ultra-right forces which have a long history of anti-Semitism, and they don't direct the insult or the critique anti-Semitism to them, but they only direct it at people who are anti-Israeli, anti-Zionist. Mm-hmm. So only if you are anti-Zionist are you anti-Semitic in the, you know. And the anti-Semites who are still running free, not just in Germany, in France, etc. They're running free. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, like I started my work, my first book, White Nation. I actually did research with Le Pen people in France and US and not just in Australia. And so I have a kind of like quite an early acquaintance with these milieus of white supremacist milieus. And in fact, these white supremacist milieus in Europe were far more anti-Semitic than they are in Australia or New Zealand. Like in Australia and New Zealand, the white supremacists are slightly removed from this tradition of anti-Semitism. It was only when I went to Europe that these people that I was studying, who were the hotbed of anti-Semitism, now they are rising to power and becoming respectable forces that the Israeli government is quite happy to deal with and have no problem at all. And all their animosity is directed towards those other supposed anti-Semites.
I mean, I think, yeah, Marine Le Pen is a great example of that, of somebody who, you know, comes from a party founded by her father, who was a Nazi himself, and deeply anti-Semitic, very vocally anti-Semitic. And at some point when she forms her policies around this idea of white nationalism and around anti-immigration, she sheds that anti-Semitism and then starts accusing her targets, the young kind of Arab and Muslim migrants that she's targeting, of anti-Semitism.
Yeah. I mean, that's why, I mean, historically. And, you know, if you want to sit down and do a rational critique of this, you're welcome. I've done it. Everybody has done it. But you come after a while to realize, you know, if rationality actually is powerful against this, it would have disappeared long ago. The fact is they are immune from it, you know, you can throw rational arguments as much as you like if you are experiencing hatred of the Israelis, you're Palestinian and you're experiencing hatred of the Israelis, after they've killed, let's say in 2014, they've killed 2,000 people. And say, well, there's a tradition of anti-Semitism among Palestinians. Mm. Say, okay, well, the rational argument, which is quite straightforward, are you trying to tell me if somebody other than Jews killed 2,000 of your people, you would kiss them? But only because they're Jews, you are sort of like, this is what it means to say they are anti-Semitic. Of course, it doesn't hold rationally, but it doesn't matter because these politics are not powerful because they're amazing of their amazing rationality. They are amazing because they perform a function for the people who use them. You know, they have a practical purpose, not a rational purpose. It's a trap we academics fall into often when we start thinking that the whole world is like one large tutorial. So I'm like, let's have an interesting discussion. Right. And, I agree, I disagree with you. And, you know, it's like saying, so I treat that in my book, is racism an environmental threat? Because when someone uses an animalistic metaphor to be racist, I say, sort of like Palestinians are cockroaches, Muslims are rats. You know, you wouldn't go and say, actually, no, they're not. let me show you rationally that they are not. I mean, it doesn't make sense.
Well, rats are important to society rats and they're are important to the ecology.
Let me take the measurement of the rat and the cockroach and the shape and the genetic makeup to show you that they are not. Of course you don't.
Because you understand that's not the intention. Okay, so,
but the reason they are saying it has a practical function. I mean, and that's what I studied in that book, because there was the transition from seeing the Muslim as cockroach to the Muslim as wolf. And so, like I said, the usage of the metaphor of wolf and wolf. And so, you know, if you're referring to someone as a cockroach, you want to squash them. If you're referring to someone as wolf, you don't squash wolves. You see them as enemies, a threat, a completely different imagination. So the racist imagination is a functional imagination. By studying it, you realize what are the intentions of the people who are using it. And the intentions are practical. They're not about knowing better. So there's no point sitting with these people and say, no, actually, let me explain to you things, etc.
Very quickly, and in the days and weeks after October 7th, there was this explosion of Islamophobic and racist tropes in the way that the Palestinian issue was being covered, and a lot of the media narratives and a lot of the front pages of tabloid press. And it was language that was very reminiscent of the early days of the War on Terror. And there was kind of a moment that I had where I was surprised at how shocked I was that this kind of language still persisted in the media, in the official language of politicians, because I had assumed that we had kind of evolved from this or kind of moved past this kind of very initial image of like the barbarism and the hordes and the Stone Age people that, you know, weren't civilized. All of that language was there, and it surfaced very quickly. How do you see that? How do you see this kind of this resurgence of all of this imagery that has been used in a lot of moments to demonize not just people in Gaza and Palestinians, but also the pro-Palestinian marches. We've seen the way that officials in the UK, for example, have not shied away from using deeply Islamophobic language to describe these people.
Look, I mean, there's two dimensions to this, in as far as I'm concerned. On one hand, it's a resurgence, as you said, but if you look at its intensity and at its tone, you'll notice that there is a little difference. And there is a difference between, if you like, colonial racism and post-colonial racism, or colonial white racism and post-colonial white racism. I think there is an element in which post-colonial whiteness sees itself as lacking compared to colonial whiteness. It imagines itself that it looks at colonial racism nostalgically. It says, it kind of like, you know, technically in theories of nostalgia means not just that you yearn for a past, but you yearn for a past that never really existed.
Mm-hmm. Make America great again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so there's this kind of white racist post-colonial imagination, which often imagines, where were the good old days when we whites just were ruled? A kind of slave imaginary. You thump people by being racist. As I said, this is the imagination, because I'm sure the slaves weren't thumped as they think they were by racism. But there is this imagination that racism was more efficient at keeping racialized people in their place.
It was more confident.
Yeah, and more powerful. and more able, and the racialized were more obedient. And so the racism that we have now is a bit desperate, because it kind of feels, why isn't my racism working? Why do these colored people and Arab people, etc., they actually are not even scared of me. And they want to protest, and they don't buy it when I look at them in as if they're inferior. They tell me to piss off. Mm-hmm. And psychoanalytically, it's like an experience of de-phallicization, in the sense of you compare your penis with the penis of your dad, and you say, oh no, my penis is not as big as my dad's penis. And so it's a bit like this, like it's, my racism is not as good
as my grandfather's
the racism of my ancestors.
Mm.
And so that comes with this anxiety, and this anxiety colors these categorizations. So there is the resurgence of the category, but when you listen to the timbre of the voice that is actually doing the racism, you find a lot of insecurity. Because of this insecurity, it always has a higher potential for violence, you know. Because here violence comes from the desire for violence, comes from a perception that your words are not achieving what they ought to achieve. It's like a bit like a violent patriarch towards, you're violent towards your wife. It's a sign of your weakness, because you are not able to rule by word alone. And this is how people are perceived in traditional settings. No one respects someone who is violent towards, it's not the norm of patriarchy. Like, it's the same. What's wrong with you? Your authority is sort of like not so there, so to speak. In Lebanese Arabic, I don't know if it's in other Arabics, you have what's called wahra. Wahra. Mm. And someone who has wahra, it means he oozes authority. Mm. So a chief who appears, he says, shuhal wahra, it means when you appear, everybody wants to obey you, because you ooze an aura of authority. It's about an aura of authority. And so I think today we have a white racism, balawara, with no aura of authority whatsoever. And so it's a bit of joke. But at the same time, it's lethal, because they're powerful people. It's not that they are not powerful people. The difference is not between powerful and non-powerful people. The difference is between secure powerful people and insecure powerful people. That's what we have now.
That's really interestingly put. And so when you look at a context like a lot of Western countries right now, a lot of European countries, but specifically countries like Germany, where you are seeing this kind of crackdown on voices that are perceived to be, you know, officially anti-Semitic, anti-Zionist, anti-Israeli, but it is happening within a context of a society that is on paper supposed to value freedom of speech, freedom of expression, freedom of assembly. How do you read what's happening there?
Well, again, there's a lot of critical historiography which shows very clearly that the nice space of democracy, the space that we fantasize about as being really nice, everybody's egalitarian, The state treats everybody as a citizen. People like to debate. They don't bash each other. Everybody sort of like have decent arguments of latte and etc. This space was historically dependent on a violent colonial space. So to enjoy your cup of tea in London, you needed violence in India. And what was the essence of the enjoyment was the ability to separate the two spaces so that you don't realize the link between your enjoyment of the cup of tea in London and the violence that's being done in India. Now, there are societies where this was much more difficult to achieve, which are colonial settler societies, because the violence and the nice space are close to each other. So it's not the colony out there in Australia. You are colonizing, and you wanted a space of enjoyment, and they weren't. One is in India, and one, it was both of them there. New Zealand, the same way. Israel, it's the same way. So the art of actually immunizing a nice space from the violence that is necessary for the formation of this nice place is much harder in the settler colony. But what's more, we are seeing a general breakdown of this ability to keep the two spaces separate. So I don't think the question is that we had democracy and now we have less democracy. I see it that the lack of democracy that used to be enclosed and safely pushed away has seeped into the metropolis. Mm. And the ability to distinguish between any place and a place where it's not democratic, it's violent, etc., the two spaces are starting to mix and fuse with each other. So we see more. It's like, there was an interesting moment where this African asylum seeker hid in the wheel of a plane, where the wheel sits, and the plane took off. And he obviously froze, and he fell in the middle of this neat bourgeois English suburb. Mm. And suddenly, the violence of asylum seekers, etc., which was there sort of like landed in the middle of the suburb. And so we are increasingly seeing situations like this. So the violence that was over there is now over here. And the person who was reliant on the suppression of the violence over there to project themselves as amazingly wonderful and neat and beautiful and democratic suddenly find themselves unable to do so. And you scratch them and you find this authoritarian thing popping up all the time. Yeah. And so you have in Germany, you can see that. In France, you can see that. All the democratic institutions, you see flashes of them turning into exactly their opposite. And, I treat a lot that in my own field work, this idea of sort of like a migrant goes to the bank, let's say, to do a transaction, And it's easy to fall into thinking, okay, I'm just a normal citizen going to the bank, which is a nice bank that treats everyone nicely. And everything is happening like this, but suddenly you notice that the gaze of the teller, just for a moment, was racist. Like, it doesn't have to be dramatic.
Yeah.
Just that split second flash where racism intrudes into the niceness of the whole bank, etc. And suddenly you realize that there's more to this than just the facade. And the whole state is like this, because it's most all European states are, on one hand, egalitarian, democratic states, but also they are white supremacist states. And white supremacy flashes out of them every now and then. It hits you. And it would be wrong to say, use that flash to say, no, there's no democracy, there's only racism. Because the difficulty is that they both coexist. It is true that the state is democratic, and it is true that a lot of migrants enjoy, in fact, the fact that they go to England, they come to Australia, and they say, you know, it's so amazing, I can go to a government office and I get what I want without needing some bloody Zaim or chef to intercede. I feel I'm treated in my own right. People experience this all the time, so it's not a false experience. There is something better and democratic. But then you get that flash of racism that reminds you that it's not just that. The state is also a white supremacist state that can put you down, take away your rights, etc. And now you see it in how a citizenship, which used to be a sacrosanct category, you know, once you're a citizen, you're a citizen. And now suddenly you say, well, we're going to take it away from you. I don't like you. So this is the opposite of the democratic state, which gives you your right as a citizen.
Mm-hmm. If I can ask you about your own experience, so you're talking about how initially you weren't, you know, you're not on the front lines of protests. You're not kind of directly engaging with it. You are focusing on the work that you're doing at the Max Planck Institute, and then at some point that changes. You begin to speak out.
No.
What changes then? What
nothing
changes in your mind?
Nothing changes. What changes is that a right-wing newspaper, Die Welt am Sonntag, The World on Sunday, they decided to do research, which they call research, which is basically snooping at my Facebook and taking quotes. They sent me this letter in which they quote from my Facebook copiously and said, do you understand that if someone read this, they think you are an anti-Semite? This was the message I got. I mean, I've had years of dealing with right-wing journalists when I worked on white supremacy, when I worked on Israel-Palestine. I know that there's no point replying because they just use whatever to say what they want to say, but add quotes from you to say it. So I didn't reply, but I immediately contacted the directors of the institute and said, there's going to be an assassination job done on me.
You felt like something was coming.
Oh, I knew. I said, that will be publishing and attacking me. It's part of what everyone has been sort of like copying it in Germany. I'll cop it. You know, if you are I mean, it's part of me being a fighter, what I do on my social media, and it's part of your ethos as a fighter. You don't complain if your enemy lands a blow against you. There's no point you whinging about it. Okay, so you're fighting, and if they win, they win, but you have to get up and fight again. So I'm not kind of like that concerned. Okay, so they land the blow, they land the blow. And so I told them, but what happened, it turned out, is that not only had they sent me this letter, they had sent it to Munich, to the president of Max Planck Society, that is the society which overlooks all the Max Planck institutes. And the guy basically gave it to some lawyers, and some lawyers immediately decided that, oh my God, look what this guy says in his Facebook. This is definitely anti-Semitic. We can't cope with it here. And Max Planck, they informed the directors of the Anthropology Institute that they needed to terminate their relation with me. And so, the president offered me I don't know what made him think that, but he kind of like offered me a no disclosure agreement, said, look, just go take your wages and go. And I kind of like was totally incensed and said, no, sack me. I want you to sack me because I want you to produce a historical document which says why you sacked me, because I am so confident that this will shame you. It will not shame me. My history speaks for itself. I'm sure you're not going to damage it. And this is what happened.
And they did put out a statement, and the statement doesn't reveal much, but it says something along the lines of some of the things that you have been saying or sharing were incompatible with the core values.
That was fine. I could have lived with that, because the statement had that part which says it's incompatible. Because incompatible, sure, if they think something and I'm incompatible, it's lovely. But then they finished it with the statement, there is no place for racism, anti-Semitism, and Islamophobia and Max Planck, which was like an implication that I engage in. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, I mean, I'm 67. I was going to make it sort of like completely without having to deal with this bullshit. And so it has come late in life for me.
Yeah.
And so I felt, no, you know, I'm in a secure position. My job in Australia is secure. My reputation is secure. If I'm not gonna make things difficult for these people, who is? So I decided, okay, that's it. I mean, you know, if nothing else, we would have made things a little bit more difficult for them. So it was win, lose, it doesn't matter.
And I mean, so you obviously have chosen the path of resistance, you have been speaking out about it, and you sharing your own thoughts, and you've received quite a considerable number of support letters and statements. Some people, some of your colleagues at the institute or in other places, have reached out to the leadership of the society and spoken to them. And I don't know how much you can talk about what steps you're taking now, but I mean, share with us what you can.
Well, I can't share anything, because not partly not because I'm into legalese, but because I Basically, my lawyer has lodged an unfair dismissal thing. I looked at it, and it's totally incomprehensible for me. It's just full of
legal jargon,
yeah. Sort of like. And according to German law, what I understand is that the employee has 2 weeks to respond to this, and I think. The action will start or not start according to what the reaction will be.
And then, what do you hope to get out of this? I mean, would you like to go back to the institute, or are you trying to make a point of the way that they had dismissed you?
Well, I mean, I can only take 2 years leave without pay from Melbourne University. So that's roughly over. So there's no point me sort of like thinking of staying longer. I've already stayed about a year and a half. So it doesn't make sense. But I definitely want or wish to sort of like, well, frankly, I just wish to make it less easy for this destructive usage of anti-Semitism. I want to make it less easy for people to engage in it because I genuinely believe it hurts, obviously, it hurts people, Arab people, Palestinian people, but it hurts also Jewish people who are subjected to anti-Semitism. You know, I mean, like at one point I was talking to someone very naively at the beginning of when this happened, and I said, should I say that I'm married to a Jewish person? My wife father is an Italian Jew who had to escape Mussolini and come to Australia, so she's the daughter of an escapee of fascism. And this German guy looks at me and said, you know, I'm sorry to tell you, but these people lecture the sons and daughters of the Holocaust about what the Holocaust and what anti-Semitism is. I don't think just being married to a Jewish person is gonna save you from anything. And so, but at the same time, you know, it's to say that I am personally linked through my wife to actual history of anti-Semitism, and I have an interest in fighting actual anti-Semitism and not letting people get away with diverting it in the way they have diverted it.
Do you think this changes the way that you approach your work as an anthropologist?
Not really. Not really. I try to create a very distinct space. You will see from my writing that I don't encourage that much what I call the colonization of the academic by the political. I like to do politics, but I like academics to maintain some autonomy so that if they contribute to the political, it'll be something else, something in addition to political space, not subservient to the need of politics. Mm-hmm. In fact, just before that happened, and I put it on my Facebook because people are interested in reading about it. One of my colleagues had sent me an email and said, Hassan, I'm starting to teach first year anthropology this year, and I wonder, what do you think, how should I change the curriculum in order to make it relevant in relation to what's happening in Gaza? Mm. And I said, I actually don't believe that you should change the curriculum. I believe you should emphasize those aspects in the anthropological tradition, which say one basic thing about anthropology is you learn how to get out of yourself to understand other spaces which are very different from you. And I think if students get this idea that it is important to get out of yourself and not be narcissistic and just think about yourself but understand others, that's already a politics against the narcissism of ethno-nationalism that you see in Zionism and in certain forms of Islamic fundamentalism as well, right?
Ghassan Haj, thank you very much for being here with us. This was a really eye-opening interview, and best of luck for, I mean, your fight, but also, you know, returning to Australia and continuing your work.
Thank you very much for having me. I really enjoyed the conversation, I think.
This episode of The Big Picture is produced by me, Mohammed Hassan, for Middle East Eye. Thank you to Hossam Sarhan for filming and Anas Ala for graphics. And thanks to you for listening. If this episode struck a chord with you, or if you disagreed with what was said, we want to hear from you. So you can reach me on Twitter at Mohammed Was Here, or by email at mh@middleeasteye.org. You can also watch all of our episodes in video format on our YouTube channel. If you like this, please consider giving us a rating, because it goes a long way and helps us reach new audiences. Until next time, salam.